be turning in your Bibles to the third chapter of the book of Esther. Now let's turn our attention to the book of Esther. This is all told more or less in a story form. And the last chapter is very exciting. And maybe you want to go over there and find out how it's going to end. You know, that's the way a fellow does sometimes. If he reads a book and it's very exciting, he just can't wait to kind of take a peek over there, you know, in the back part to see how it's going to all come out. Well, I can tell you without taking a peek, you're welcome to do so if you want to, that it's all going to come out well in the end. And that's certainly the way that God would always have it with his people. It'll come out well one way or the other. It may not seem well to us, but it'll seem well to him if that's the way it ends up. But all will go well with Esther and Mordecai in the end. But right now, it looks pretty dark for the Jewish people. It's a very sad time in their history. It's not an unusual time because it's been many times repeated since, and it was many times repeated before the time that we'll read about in this text. There has always been an attempt on the part of the devil to exterminate the Jewish people. You can go all the way back to the problems that Abraham and Isaac and Jacob had. You can go back to the time of the Egyptian bondage, and you can take it right on down all the way up until the time when Jesus was born, and again, little baby Jews were being killed in Jerusalem and round about. And there have been many attempts since to annihilate this particular race or class of people that's called the Jews in the Bible. All right, now let's look into this third chapter and see how that one man is going to be exalted in the government and how that his exaltation will pose no small problem to those Jews, that 127 provinces of the Persian Empire. Incidentally, his nationality is very important, and we'll pay some attention to that. There was really bad blood between the Israelites and the Amalekites, and we'll see that as we go into this lesson. In the first four verses, we see how that Haman was promoted by King Xerxes, and how that after his promotion, that Mordecai refused to recognize him as this high official of the king. So he got a promotion on one hand, and he was despised then by one of the fellows of the court on the other hand. So he had a little promotion there backed up by a problem. And so he set out to relieve the problem in a rather unusual way. Let's read the first verse now. After these things, that is, after Esther became the queen, and after the conspiracy was made known to the king by Esther, which had come from the secret known to Mordecai, after these things, this happened here. After these things did King Ahasuerus promote Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, and advance him and set his seat above all the princes that were with him. Assuming that out of the 127 provinces, there were princes over each of the provinces, that would indicate that this man was the greatest out of all the other 126 princes that were there representing their various provinces there in the court of Persia. So I would say that it looks to me like that Haman has been made prime minister, that he has been given an official position that is next in power to the king himself. So he's more or less become what we'd term the right-hand man of King Xerxes. And he's got quite an advance there from the position that he probably originally had. Now looking at this man Haman from what follows, because there's not a great deal said prior to this time, he was a man that had no honor and no sense of justice whatever. He was a very proud, ambitious, passionate man that was given to all sorts of evil. And that will be borne out by what follows later here in this book. You know, we pointed out, especially there in chapter 2, how that God was working behind the scene when he brought Esther to be the queen, and how that he gave Mordecai a position in the government like. But you know, while God has been working in his providence, it's also an evident fact that the devil has also been working, that through his providence, if you want to call it that, he has brought into power this man Haman in order to further his program in the kingdom of Persia. So while God works, please do not ever forget that the devil also works. And one is out to defeat the other, as it were. And God, being greater in power, will always win the victory. Though the devil at times may seem to give God, in our opinion, a temporary setback, as will appear from the lesson tonight. I believe here was a man that knew how to exact homage out of the people. He knew how to win the smiles and the frowns of people. He knew how to terrify his enemies. And he knew how to get rid of rivals that got in his way. I would assume that he was a pretty good politician if out of the 127 provinces he got to be the top dog. That meant there's about 100 and something other fellows he had to outwit and outsmart to get the job. So he was quite a politician, is what I'm telling you. Now, his nationality is spelled out there in verse 1. He's a Agagite, and that, of course, is a common name of all the princes of this man that was known as Amalek in the Old Testament. You can read about that in the 24th chapter of the book of Numbers. In verse 7, you'll see that it was the family name, like, of the kings or princes of the Amalekites. But in order to fully understand the bad blood between the Amalekites and Israel, we need to go back and look at some things that happened and a prediction that the Lord made. Incidentally, there are different pronunciations of what I'm calling Amalekites. Some Bibles have it Amalekites, but what I've never understood, they still call the man Amalek. But when you put the I-T-E on it, it seems to take on a different pronunciation in some cases. It's far simpler for me just to let it be the ites and have Amalekites. So your Bible may be accented Amalekites, so you can call it that if you want to. I'm just saying it's easier for me to let the man's name stand and just put the I-T-E on it and the S and call it like the original name of the man is. But if you go back to the 17th chapter of the book of Exodus, you'll find out when there was first a battle between the Amalekites and Israel. And if you go into a lot of the details, they attacked the hindmost part of the camp. They attacked the weak and the disabled. That's pretty much the devil's strategy a lot of times, if you'll note. And anyway, the Israelites never seemed to forget that battle. Neither did they forget the prediction that God made concerning these people. Let's start in that 17th chapter at verse 8. Then came Amalek and fought with Israel in Rephidim. And Moses said unto Joshua, choose us out men and go out, fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with the rod of God in my hand. So Joshua did as Moses said to him and fought with Amalek. And Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. And it came to pass, when Moses held up his hand, that Israel prevailed. And when he let down his hand, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands were heavy. And they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat thereon, and Aaron and Hur stayed up his hands, the one on the one side, and the other on the other side, and his hands were steady until the going down of the sun. And Joshua discomfited Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. And the Lord said unto Moses, write this for a memorial in a book, and rehearse it in the ears of Joshua, for I will utterly put out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. I don't recall that God ever made a statement like that about many people other than these Amalekites. And Moses built an altar and called the name of it Jehovah Nissa, for he said, because the Lord has sworn that the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. So there was to be a strife between Israel and these Amalekites. It would not just be this little event that had happened here during their travel in the wilderness, but it would be a warfare that would go on for generation and generation, almost without any end. And so it's remarkable in that respect. Now, I want us to look at another passage about the Amalekites in Deuteronomy 25. And it's nothing more than a reminder of the 17th chapter of the book of Exodus. But I believe I can show you from these scriptures why it was that Mordecai would not bow before this man who was a descendant of Amalek. As a matter of fact, I believe he took Deuteronomy 25 and 17 serious. He believed what God said, and therefore he acted in the way that he did. Remember what Amalek did unto thee by the way when ye came forth out of Egypt. Well, evidently, Mordecai remembered. That's why he wouldn't bow. He wasn't going to bow to those enemies of his people. Then the Lord goes on to tell us how he met thee by the way and smote the hindmost of thee, even all that were feeble behind thee, when thou wast faint and weary, and he feared not God. My, my, how the devil does wage war just like that. He comes first of all to our back instead of our face. There is no armor for the back of the Christian soldier, if you remember there in Ephesians 6. He usually attacks those that are feeble and that are behind, are backslid. He gets a hold of those that are faint and weary and who have at least a limited fear of God. That's the way he does. That's the way he's been waging war all these years. That's the way the Amalekites fought with Israel. Then in verse 19, therefore it shall be when the Lord thy God hath given thee rest from all of thine enemies round about, in the land that the Lord thy God giveth thee for an inheritance to possess it, that thou shalt blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. Thou shalt not forget it. Now, God said that. It wasn't just a statement handed down from the old patriarchs. It was Jehovah himself that said, blot out these people from under heaven. Don't ever forget how they treated you when you were coming out of the land of Egypt. Well, I know one man that didn't forget. His name was Mordecai, though he lived many years after the time of the journey there of the Israelites in the wilderness. So, I don't know. There's a lot said about these people. I remember Saul, 1 Samuel 15. He spared Agag, who was an Amalekite, the very best of the sheep and the flocks, and destroyed only that was no good. And as a result of it, God told him it was better to obey than to sacrifice. And King Saul lost his kingdom for that act, because he forgot how that Amalek had treated Israel. The prophet Samuel came on the scene and took a sword and cut in pieces the king of the Amalekites, Agag, in the very presence of Saul the king. Samuel remembered Amalek, as God told him. So there was bad blood between these people. It goes back a long way. Would probably be far worse than the Hatfields and the McCoys in that story that we've heard about very well here in this section of the country. So I don't know anything about this man other than what we're told here in this book. He was an Amalekite, and he was one of the princes of Amalek. And that's the reason why there was bad blood between him and Mordecai right on the start. I don't know how well they knew one another, but they knew one another's nationality. And you'll detect from what follows that when Haman found out that Mordecai was a Jew, that's all he needed to know. He is already mad when he found that out, you see. He was already offended that he hadn't bowed to him, and he really got mad when he found out he was a Jew after that. So here we go with the rest of the story now. The bad blood is going to come head on, as it were, in confrontation there around the king's gate. near the palace and all of that, because Mordecai will refuse to reverence Haman, as the other people of the court were evidently doing at that time. And that's what we see in verse 2. And all the king's servants that were in the king's gate bowed. Just about everybody else now was doing it. And reverenced Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. And in that day, if you didn't carry out the will of the king, they probably might kill you a lot of times. It may have meant death. But for the grace of God and the mercy of God, it probably would have meant death in the case of Mordecai. And so it goes on to say, but. A little word, but. That makes a lot of difference sometimes, you know. But Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence. Now, can you imagine what a scene that must have been? In the mental picture, I can just see it. Royal court of Persia. Beautiful palace there in Shushan. People around everywhere. Ministers of states, princes, various scribes and all this going in and out of the courts. And here comes Haman marching in early in the morning. Everybody standing out there at the king's gate. All of them bow down before him. One fellow standing there, though, as if he's looking up at the birds and the bees. His back just like he's got a brick up it or something. Just won't bow, won't pay any attention to him, won't speak to him, won't have any dealings with him, whatever. Now, somebody said, now that's a stupid thing to do. Why does that fellow want to be such a hard-nosed boy anyway? Don't you know that he might have got himself killed? Don't you know that they might have found out that he was a cousin of the queen and might have executed him and the queen? This is a terrible thing. And somebody might have said, well, now, you know, later on, the Bible said to show honor to whom honor is due and all of that. This man was a high minister in the court, so Mordecai ought to bow to him. Fellows could have reasoned a lot of different things there, you know. And I can imagine that it wasn't easy to buck the crowd, to go against the trend of that time, but there was one old fellow there in the crowd that had a very stiff backbone. His name was Mordecai. Didn't make any difference how many times that Haman went in and out, he didn't pay any attention to him. He wouldn't bow down. Well, that reminds me of three other fellows. Their name were, well, they had their names changed when they got down to Babylon, but their names that we probably remember them by was Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. When all the other people out there in the plains of Babylon were bowing down before that great metallic man that Nebuchadnezzar had made, there were some very stiff-backed Jews there that wouldn't bow down again. And so they were cast in the fire furnace because of it. But God preserved them by a miracle. Very much like he's going to preserve the Israelites here by, in my estimation, still a notable miracle as well. So here he is. Why, though, wouldn't he bow to it? Well, I really believe that it goes back to the fact that the Lord said, don't remember these people except in a bad sense. Don't forget what they did to your nation. How that they tried to take you from the hindmost part. They came in like cowards and attacked. And after all, he wasn't going to bow before a race of people that had been doomed and damned by God. It may seem cruel, but I think that's the way he felt about it. Was it ordinarily the rules, though, that the Jews would show no respect to the high officials in Babylon? Well, we certainly remember here from the book of Daniel how many times that he spoke very respectful to the king there of Babylon. So there's nothing wrong, actually, with showing respect to those in position of authority. The Jews many times did that. And I could cite many examples out of Samuel and Kings and Chronicles and other places, as well as the book of Daniel, when Jews did bow before the king, and they did show proper respect and all of this. But there was a reason why that Mordecai wouldn't bow. It may be more than the fact that the Lord said, remember these people in a bad sense. It was not uncommon in that day for the kings of Persia, even the high officials, to be known as Lord and God, and to ask that the people worship them as divine. Now that would indicate that it would be an act of idolatry. To bow down before a man who claimed to be a god would have been idolatry. And believe me that Mordecai, who took his religion serious, had no intentions of doing that. So I think there was a little more to it than that. He wanted divine honors, as if he was some sort of a deity. That's why that Mordecai would not bow down. And that's the same reason why the three Hebrews would not bow down before the golden image, because that image was a symbol of a heathen god, as it was. And the Jews only worshiped one God, Jehovah. They would not pay homage to any other god. Well, whether Haman completely understood the situation or not, I don't know. I suppose that he had some knowledge of it from his ancestry, if I had to guess. So then look what happens as we go on down to verse 3. Then the king's servants, which were in the king's gate, said to Mordecai, "Why transgressest thou the king's commandment?" He said, "Are you a dumb Jew? Don't you know what the king said? You got to bow down." And it came to pass, when they spake daily unto him, and he hearkened not unto them, that they told Haman to see whether Mordecai's matters would stand. For he had told them that he was a Jew. In other words, I guess he said something like this: "I'm a Jew, I only worship one God, I'll never bow down before this man that's the enemy of my people and claims that he's a god of some kind. I'm not going to do it," he said, "no matter what happens to me." Well, his friends tried to tell him he's going to get in trouble. Said, "You've ignored the king's commandment. There'll be a consequence. You're going to get yourself killed. You better bow down." But he didn't pay any attention to them. And so, I suppose there were serious consequences that could follow here. But here was a man that believed that God meant what he said. And he didn't care what happened to him. He is going to do what God said no matter what. He said, "Well, they're going to kill him." "Well, he'll just die," he said. "He's not going to bow down no matter what." And what I'd like to see in our modern world is a lot of God's people has got a strong backbone, like Mordecai, like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that take seriously the word of God and just simply won't bow down. I'm telling you that they're few and far between in our modern world. But here was a man, and I tell you what, I suppose about all the other Jews around there were bowing down. I hate to say it, but I'm sure there were others around there in that big palace of Shushan. There's just one fellow, though, had the nerve to buck the crowd. His name was Mordecai. I suppose all the rest of the boys were bowing down and trying to confess their sins at night in the closet and said, "Lord, forgive me. If I don't do it, I'll get my head cut off, you know." So maybe that's the way they operated. I can just imagine, though, that everybody else was bowing down, but this one man had a strong backbone. So this man Haman, he plots a holocaust. He said, "We'll just get rid of all these Jews. They won't bow down. They won't show any respect. They won't abide by the laws of the kingdom. We'll exterminate them out of the kingdom. That's the way to get rid of them." And so he sets out on a plot. Here in verse 5 to 6, he sets out to plan on what I'd call a holocaust. "And when Haman saw that Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence," and the fact that word reverence keeps being used, sounds to me that somehow he wanted to be worshipped as a god there, looks to me like. "Then was Haman full of wrath." He said, "Of all things, everybody else bows down. Here's a smart aleck that won't." Imagine that. And worse than any of it, he's a Jew, the enemy of my people. "And he thought scorn to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had showed him the people of Mordecai." Said he's a Jew, and there's other Jews around here like him. "Wherefore Haman sought to destroy all the Jews that were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, even the people of Mordecai." So Hitler wasn't the first fellow that decided that we ought to get rid of the Jews. Pharaoh was one of the early men that came to that conclusion. And here we see another man that has decided that there ought to be a great holocaust. Just get rid of all these Jews. They don't abide by the laws of the kingdom. Nobody likes them anyway, so we're just going to burn them all up. We're going to hang them all. We're going to get rid of them somehow. We just don't want them around. So I can imagine that Haman was reasoning something like this. Said, "If he won't bow his head in my presence, then I'll have that little head removed from his shoulders. And if I can't have his honor then I'll have his blood scattered up and down the streets of Shushan. I suppose that's about the way he felt. Now, this man was bloody and cruel, granting that Mordecai might have shown him some sort of disrespect. Was that any reason to kill little babies and mothers and all the Jews all over this empire, including those that had gone back already to Palestine and were there in the city of Jerusalem? He didn't care whether little infants died or not. He didn't care whether mothers died or not. He didn't care whether old women were beat to death or hanged on a tree. He said, they're Jews, kill a whole bunch of them. I don't care what you do to them. Isn't it strange how that of all the nations on the face of the earth, it seems like there's only one that people time after time try to exterminate? You ever thought about that? How many times has it been repeated what was said in Psalms 83 and verse 4? The enemies of Israel there said, they have said, come and let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may no more be in remembrance. Now, that was the sentiments of this fellow Haman, I'll guarantee you. He said, let's get rid of all of them. I don't even want to hear that name Israel anymore. And all the palace of Shushan, just kill them all. Then we won't have to be bothered with fellows like that. Well, there were problems coming up because he thought, well, now if I go in and tell the king that I want to kill all these people, and most of them probably pretty well to do, knowing Jews, I'm sure that they had some money in that day, just like now. The king would have probably said, now, wait a minute. That's going to cost a lot of money. These fellows pay a lot of taxes, you know. And this is going to hit the king's treasury pretty hard. I don't know whether I could go along with that or not. So Haman is a man of some wealth, and he intends to kind of butter the king up and get him to go along with it because he's going to make a little contribution to the cause. And where do you think he's going to get the money? From all these dead Jews is what he's planning on doing. I guarantee you how he's going to handle it. Of course, it didn't work out like he planned, but he's going to kill them all and get their possessions, then give the king a little cut out of it. I'm sure that's the way he had it all planned. So we want to go on now to the seventh verse here as we see how that other things begin to develop. And the plot is almost laid out in every detail at this point. And then, of course, later there'll be the disruption by God. But here's the plot. Sometimes I wonder about this plot. Boy, wasn't Haman a real brave man. He was going to attack the poor, scattered people, had no organization, no weapons of war, and no political ability. Just attack them and kill them all. Now, did that take a brave man to do that, or was that a coward? Well, you can decide. You know, in spite of all this plot, these plans that he's laying out, there was in heaven one that hates Rome. There was one in heaven that controls the affairs of human beings. There was one in heaven that is a helper of the helpless. He was looking on, and he too had some plans, altogether different than those that Haman had come up with so far. So beginning there at verse 7 down to the end of the chapter, the date's set for the massacre, and it seems like that it's going to be a terrible time for the Jewish people, that there will be a complete extermination of them. Now, if all the Jews were killed, then there would not be born one day out of the tribe of Judah a man called Jesus Christ. So this is a plot of the devil to destroy the ancestry of the king. Many of them in the Old Testament. Here's another. And Haman said unto King Ahasuerus, there is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of thy kingdom. That shows how the Jews were probably in all these 127 provinces. And their laws are diverse from all people. That's especially their dietary laws. They didn't eat catfish. They didn't eat rabbits and stuff like that. Neither keep they the king's laws. Well, as far as I know, they did. They probably had certain holy days, like they still have, that they kept. And they wouldn't do certain things that were contrary to their religion. But outside of that, they did obey the law from all records we have of them. So this is really just a little bit of the truth and mostly a lie that he's telling. Neither keep they the king's law, therefore it is not for the king's profit to suffer them. Said they're no good. Said get rid of them. They're a detriment to the whole kingdom. Now listen, to butter him up, here he comes with the proposition. If it please the king, let it be written. that they may be destroyed. He didn't just want them put in jail. He wanted them destroyed. And I will pay 10,000 talents of silver to the hands of those that have the charge of the business. I assume to those that were the receivers of the king's treasury. He'd give that money to the treasuries of the kingdom. To bring it into the king's treasuries. So now if you're worried about the loss in taxes and all of that, he said, I'll make up for it. He said, I'll throw in some money to take care of it. Matter of fact, he said, I'll make it to the tune of 10,000 talents of silver. That was a lot of money even in that day. Today would be millions and millions of dollars, as anybody would know. And the king took his ring from his hand and gave it unto Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the Jews' enemy. Mark the language there, the Jews' enemy. And the king said unto Haman, the silver is given to thee, the people also, to do with them as it seemeth good to thee. He said, I don't want to be bothered with it. You can have your money. You do the dirty work too. You do the dirty work. You keep your money. I don't want any of it. As if to say, like Pilate, I want to stay out of it. And then look at that big old long verse there next. Do you know one anywhere in the Bible is any longer than that? Look at it. In fact, I believe that you'll find that it's the longest verse in the Bible, is it not? It's very long. Then were the king's scribes called on the 13th day of the first month. There was written according to all that Haman had commanded unto the king's lieutenants and to the governors that were over every province and to the rulers of every people of every province according to the writing thereof and to every people after their language in the name of King Ahasuerus, was it written and sealed with the king's ring. So then you had the official insignia of the king on these documents and made them valid throughout all the empire. And the letters were sent by post into all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to cause to punish all Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day, even upon the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month Adar, and to take the spoil of them for a prey. And so, here are some interesting things that are developing at this particular point. Let's go back and see if we can't ascertain a few things that will be stated here. Well, let's go on and read the rest of it, and then we'll come back and look at a few statements that's contained here. The copy of the writing for a commandment to be given in every province was published unto all people that they should be ready against that day. The post went out, being hastened by the king's commandment, and the decree was given in Shushan, the palace, and the king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city Shushan was perplexed. Now, going back up there to the word post and looking up some of those original words, there's something that happened here that's not so clear in our version, but it's more clear in the Hebrew text. Evidently, the diviners that were often coming in the court of the king came in and they cast lots. That's what they did. They cast lots to try to determine which would be the best time of the year to kill all these Jews. The funny thing about it was that they cast a lot for every day and every month, and it was almost a year before it would be time, according to the diviners. Why was it that the lots just accidentally, shall we say, seemed to be accidentally in the minds of the world, certainly not accidentally with God, but why was it that it just came out that they had almost a year before the time of their execution? And why did the lots turn out that way? Why were they that lucky, as they say today? Well, it wasn't anything to do with luck, whatever. It was all providence. Well, I believe I can give you the answer by reading in the book of Proverbs, the 16th chapter, in the last verse of that chapter. The Lord was in control of those lots that were cast. It said there in the 16th chapter, in verse 33, The lot is cast into the lap, but the whole disposing thereof is of the Lord's. So God was allowing them some time, allowing Esther to establish herself in Mordecai, to get himself in position that the Holocaust might be averted. And God is doing all of that. It's been some 4 years after the marriage of Esther, and they all start the lot casting there in and around about what's near to February or March, and they decide that the best time to carry it out would be something like December to January that's following there, so you got almost a year of time that's involved. Now, why is it that people today always say, don't do it on the 13th day, especially not on Friday? You ever wondered about that? Well, it may very well go back to some of these scriptures here, because it was on the 13th day of the month that the Jews would be executed. I don't know. I often wondered. That might may be the case. It's just supposition on my part. You know, all of this idea about being lucky. You know, some fellows get up and say, this is going to be my lucky day. A lot of times it doesn't turn out that way at all. As a matter of fact, it seems like the Lord in His providence just about turns it around and makes it His unlucky day, it seems like. But really, there is no such thing as a lucky day and an unlucky day. That's all heathen superstition. People say, don't let a black cat go across the road in front of you. Don't walk underneath the ladder. All of this is nothing more than heathen superstition. Has no place among God's people. God can take care of us on the 13th as well as He can any other time. He sure did these people. So we must at all times trust the providence of God, the 13th and Friday the 13th notwithstanding. God's always with His people. When you go to talking about luck, just remember that's heathen superstition. That's where it all comes from. And it goes back to these old diviners in the Persian courts and those old soothsayers and all in the courts of Babylon. It all goes back to that. So there have been a lot of accusations brought here. Said this man is a Jew. He's a Jew, and so we ought to get rid of him because he's a Jew. So everything seems to be going according to plans. The scribes write down all of these edicts, and they're sent out by the messengers to all the 127 provinces. And I can imagine that the poor old Jews, when they saw these posted in a public place, must have been very distressed, because they only had maybe 10 months to live. And their wives and their children and everybody would be put to death. Everything would be destroyed. And maybe some of the old-timers said, if this happens, said, what about the Messiah that's supposed to be born? How is He going to get in the world if all the Jews are going to be killed all over the world? Well, the devil's behind it. You'd think that after a man had laid a plot like that he might want to go and do some penance. If not repent, maybe do some penance. But you know, neither Xerxes or Haman had any desire to make any change or to do any different. What did they do? They said, well, let's go drown all of our conscience in a little bottle of booze. And they did. So let's go get drunk. We'll forget about all them screaming kids and women that's going to get killed about 10 months from now. And we'll just think all about how much better off we're going to be after all these Jews are killed. Isn't it strange how that a lot of politicians can do the most unscrupulous things in the world and then drown it all out with a little drink. Just like it is here in this chapter, still going on today. The world really hasn't changed very much. Still very much like it was then. They can rob the people, they can murder the people, and get drunk and forget all about it. Doesn't bother their conscience at all. They seem to have no conscience. It must be seared with a hot iron, I think, sometime. So the people, though, are perplexed, they're distressed, they're disturbed. Why? Because they know that the king is not being just. He's being unfair with his subjects. Over here in Ecclesiastes chapter 3 and verse 16, it said, moreover, I saw under the sun the place of judgment, that wickedness was there. Well, that's what the people saw in Shushan, the palace, when they thought of Xerxes and Haman. They looked at the place of judgment. They saw that wickedness was there. He goes on to say the place of righteousness and iniquity was there. Then, of course, the wise man said in his heart, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked. There is a time there for every purpose and for every work. So a righteous God will certainly indeed judge and take vengeance on those that have set out to destroy his people, through which the Messiah must come. Christ has not yet been born. He must come from Judah. He must come out of this nation that's about now to be exterminated. The devil will not win. God will get the victory. But right now it looks pretty dark, looks pretty doleful for these that were Jews scattered throughout the Persian Empire. Well, that's our lesson for tonight, and we'll stop. We'll be in chapter 4 the next time.